Okay, we'll get started in 2 minutes. Greetings, everybody. This is Elizabeth Thompson from the Buckminster Fuller Institute. Thank you so much for joining us on a Friday evening, at least on the East Coast of the United States. We're delighted to have you join us for what is our second read for our truly globally distributed Dymaxion Reading Group. We launched this program this year on the occasion of the 120th anniversary of Bucky's birth, and we started with operating manual for Spaceship Earth, and we formed this group to respond to the real persistent interest from our network to engage directly with Bucky's writings and also to find others with whom to sort of support and deepen that process. We've been overwhelmed by the response and just are thrilled to continue this and to have you here. So welcome aboard. Tonight will be the first of two discussions devoted to Critical Path, which was published by St. Martin's Press in 1981, just a couple of years before Bucky's passing in 1983. Many people have, they've remarked to me over the years that for them, if they were, in their opinion, if they were only able to read one of Bucky's books, Critical Path would be it, as it contains most, if not all, of his most important ideas. Importantly, in a form that is more accessible than some of his other texts. I'm not sure our moderator and respondents tonight would agree with this, but and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. But this is an important overview of Fuller's most seminal ideas. And I hope we'll hear a little bit about the origins of this book and its sort of position amongst Bucky's publications from one of our panelists, Jamie Snyder, when we get started. I did want to make sure that you knew that this book is now available for the first time in an e-reader format on Apple iBooks and I believe also on Kindle. Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth is also available in the e-reader format, so we hope you will check this out and spread the word. We're truly thrilled at this development of having his publications be available in a digital format. I really want to thank all of you who have joined us this evening as a member of the Buckminster Fuller Institute. If you haven't already joined us, we really encourage you to participate as a member and take advantage of the benefits of our membership program. The support from our membership really directly enables us to offer these kinds of programs and you know, all of the other programs that we are able to offer at the Institute. You can find out more about all of this on our website, bfi.org. And I want to make sure that you all are aware that we are celebrating the winner of the 2015 Fuller Challenge in New York City on November 19th. And I hope you will all consider joining us for that wonderful celebration. If you haven't already received an invitation via email, you will at the conclusion of this discussion tonight. And it's a wonderful way to find out more about the challenge program, meet our finalists and our winner, and most importantly, meet each other. It's an opportunity to network and celebrate the great work that is profiled in that program. So tonight, our discussion will be led by Greg Watson. Greg is a former board member of the Buckminster Fuller Institute, and he most recently served as the 19th Commissioner of Agriculture for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts under Governor Deval Patrick. Greg is currently serving as the Schumacher Center for New Economics Director of Policy and Systems Design. So we're totally thrilled that Greg is leading this discussion. We couldn't have a better guide. We also have joining with us three respondents who will be adding to the discussion when they sort of feel the spirit moving them. Joining us tonight is Kurt Pizbilla, who is an inventor, educator, and longtime BFI associate. We work with Kurt on synergetic geometry workshop programs, among many other things. Pablo Freund is also here tonight. He was a staff member of BFI and recently left to launch his own social venture called B-Girl. You can find out more about that at bgirl.org or com. Pablo, you can correct me on that. And last but not least, Jamie Snyder is here with us. Jamie is a filmmaker, musician, and the executor of the estate of Buckminster Fuller. He's the founder of the Buckminster Fuller Institute, along with his mother, Allegra. He's also the editor of the Lars Mueller editions of the republication of some of Bucky's most seminal books. So I thank you all for joining us. Linda Booth Sweeney was also going to join us tonight and had a last-minute conflict and won't be here tonight, but I'm hoping she'll be with us for the second discussion of Critical Path. Let's see. I'm going to turn this over to Sharifa Taki, who is going to just talk about some of the technical aspects of participating in the discussion tonight.
Hi, everyone. Some of you have already discovered this feature, but basically throughout the discussion, if you have any questions or comments, you can enter them into the questions box or chat box on your control panel. It will come to us. And if you would like to actually ask the question live to the panelists, please click the hand button that raises your hand and it will let me know that you'd like to actually speak. And then if we have a good time, we will invite you to speak by name and unmute you, and then you can ask your question live.
And give us a sense of what your question's about.
Yes, but please do email us the question so it gives us a sense of what your question is so we can find the right and appropriate time. And if you have questions, again, you can email me at contact@bfi.org if for any reason your control panel is not working, and I can address your questions that way as well.
Great, thank you. So I am going to just circle back to you, Jamie. If you would just share with us a little bit about Critical Path and how this book came into being, and where, as I mentioned earlier, sort of where you see it fitting in the canon, if you will, of Bucky's publications in his thinking process.
Well, let's see. You know, my recollection is that the book began because Bucky was writing an essay called Twilight of the World's Power Structures, and it, as many things that Bucky did, especially in the writing realm, it, as he got writing, then things kept expanding. He initially was working very closely with Tom Benetz, and they were doing a lot of work in Southern California. But you have to realize this was published 2 years before Bucky passed on, and I think to give you a little bit of other backdrop, you know, Bucky was, at the time he was working on it, was 84, 85. He also, I believe this was the first project he did where he was working very closely with Kiyoshi Kurumiya, who was the credited on in the book on the cover as the adjuvant, which is somewhere in the realm of an assistant or an associate. But Kiyoshi was a beautiful, beautiful, brilliant fellow who was kind of handling the nuts and bolts. You know, he was a fast typist. He would edit stuff and feed it back to Bucky, and they'd work it over. And I remember a couple of summers when they were just off in Maine at a place, a house Bucky had on the coast of Maine, and he would come up for intensive, you know, for a few weeks in the summer, and a lot of what they did was just sit there and work on this out on the porch and cranking out draft after draft. And I think for Bucky, I have a feeling that it was, there was a sense of him that just felt that this was a moment, I think it just was a kind of a need to make a very comprehensive statement. I imagine at some deep level, he realized that he was getting older and didn't know. I know that he was the kind of person who would from time to time say, you know, I have no idea how long I'm going to be around, so I've got to really live each moment as if it is just this moment. I've got to give it my all, and we live in urgent times. We all, I think, feel that very much the way Bucky did at that time. He felt the urgency, which is reflected in the title. He felt that urgency, and I think in some ways this comprehensive statement, Elizabeth said it well, it really is a broad comprehensive statement, with perhaps the only sort of exception, it doesn't get in too much depth around synergetics, though he certainly makes references and uses quotes of that. But it's a very comprehensive book, and I think Kiyoshi had a real, they had a really good working relationship, and I think Kiyoshi did a fantastic job kind of facilitating the process working well and being able to keep confronting Bucky with himself and, you know, get his hands on research easily, even though this was kind of pre-internet. So that was a more involved process to be able to do research. So I don't, I'd be happy to talk more about it as we go. I just, sort of unrelated to the subject of the book per se, I do just want to make a comment and sort of jumping off of this, which is, myself, we were talking just briefly before you all got on the call, and I for one, am You know, I know a lot of people over the years read Bucky, and their, you know, their first take is, wow, you know, gee, it's a little hard to grasp all of it. I think thanks to Kiyoshi, this book actually has a readability, you know, an increased readability, makes it much more accessible. But yet, it's a huge book, a broad statement. But I for one, you know, we may get into talking about all sorts of subjects, but I for one know that a lot of folks, when they come to first encounter Bucky, they have a little hard time getting comfortable with the language and even grasping certain things Bucky's trying to say. So I would certainly encourage those of you who may feel that way to actually ask if there are particular passages and things that you are struggling with or thinking about and would like some reflection. So I just didn't want to really encourage you to do that. This is for you.
Thanks, Jamie. So on that note, I'm going to invite you, Greg, to kick us off. I'm hearing a bit of an echo on my end.
Headphones?
Yeah. We'll solve it on our end, but Greg, I just want to invite you to kick us off and start us out on our journey of discovery here.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I want to sort of say that I think we want to maybe turn this a little bit on its head, and I don't see myself as leading this. I'm hoping that the participants, the listeners online and on the phone, will actually take the lead. And as Jamie suggested, this is sometimes talking about Bucky, it's hard to find some cohorts out there that you can sit down and sort of just kind of have discussions and sort of clarify things. So we want to make sure we leave a lot of time for that. But we'd like to say a few things and then invite Kurt and Pablo to kind of just give some observations briefly to kick it off. If it turns out, I think people are biting out there at the bit to ask some questions, and I'm going to make that assumption so we can get to those sooner than later. And if not, then we can certainly have things that we have to say. And it's one of the reasons we put together the information packet as well, to sort of pull out some of the salient points, although it doesn't do justice. I mean, I think everyone hopefully will have it if you haven't read Critical Path already. We'll read it. Let me begin by saying that the Critical Path is a very radical book. And I think one of the things for me that it does is dispel sort of the myth that Bucky was politically naive. And if you've read any of it and get a sense, I think you have to come away with the impression that Bucky was anything but politically naive, and basically was able to unearth and reveal the real workings of the dysfunctional political systems throughout the world, and make probably the most salient argument for why we had to get on this critical path, to quote from a title of one of his earlier books, and make the choice between utopia and oblivion. So the timing of it and the importance of it is, I guess we would say this with every passing year, every passing decade, but it's never been more important, given the state of the world and the issues that we're facing, from climate change to, again, political dysfunction. I won't go into that. We all know that. But I think it's important to understand how we got here. And I think that's one of the most important things about Critical Path, is it really helps us sort of understand how the systems work, how the systems have been manipulated, but then how we can make them work for us, and how things have changed over the years away from there being sort of that monopolizing of information by the, quote, great pirates or the political powers of the world, whom Jimmy has mentioned are now in the twilight, to the point in history now where we have the information. And that information, because of technology, is accessible to just about everyone. And that means that we all have a potential role to play, critical role to play, in writing Spaceship Earth. And again, writing Spaceship Earth for us. This isn't about saving the planet, it is about saving us. So having said that, again, we've got a lot of folks online. I just wanted to make, I'm going to do something that's a little bit uncharacteristic before I ask Kurt and Pablo to sort of just give some opening comments. I'm going to quote someone other than Bucky to try to put in perspective why I think Bucky's outlook and the lens through which he's, those thick lenses through which he looked, is so unique. And this is a quote from Sanford Quinter in a, it was an article in the 1997 issue of Architecture New York. And it was actually a pretty strident article criticizing the architectural industry's treatment of Bucky over the years, when Bucky was a maverick at a time when being a maverick was not fashionable. And he challenged, as you know, the architectural community, but was doing it in a way that, you know, he was talking about smart homes and smart buildings, and before anybody even had a sense of what that was. But this was a, an article, again, called Fuller Things. Let me just do this really quickly because I think it sort of will help set the stage in terms of what his unique perspective was. He saw the world economic system earlier and more explicitly than anyone else as an alloy of gigantic proportions and complexity, sweating properties left and right, a geometric modulus of existing and possible performances determined only by the particular phase in which it is at any moment caught. He saw the total infrastructural gestalt that underlay every technical performance or design actualization. He knew the alchemy of interstreaming numbers, financial, chemical, industrial, physical, just as certain material scientists are said to intuitively feel the interaction of molecules. His understanding of the nature and importance of information led to the first call for an anticipatory design practice. Today, one might speak of predictive design in the sense of markets. Fuller was the first to understand the possibilities and critical role that telegraphy and radio could and already do indeed play in the world informational tensegrity imaging, how change over time, algorithms and markets, populations and resources could be made visible and concrete and made to enter directly into our design intuition. So he made the invisible visible, and that revealed the again the discontinuity, the dysfunctioning, the deceit, and of the power structures that he so rightly claimed would be in Twilight, and that's all the isms that he talked about. So again, you've had a chance hopefully to read the book, maybe take a look at a little of the crib sheets. We'll come back to some specifics in a bit, but we do want to again sort of provide some time to hear from you. So I did ask Kurt though to, and again I put Kurt a little bit on the spot to take a crack at actually defining what Bucky meant when he talked about critical path thinking and critical path conceptioning. So Kurt, can I throw that at you? Kurt?
Yeah, sorry, I was having a little trouble unmuting.
Oh, sorry, okay.
So I just wanted to start by saying, first of all, I love to hear the piece that you just read. I'd never heard it before, but I think it really does set the stage well. And just to take a step back and speak to the point that Elizabeth made at the beginning, I think that Critical Path is very key work to understanding Bucky, and it's whenever anybody is asking me about it, it's the one that I recommend. If they know nothing about Bucky, I think it's a very good introduction in his own words. And Jamie, thank you for explaining more about the process with Kiyoshi, because I think that it actually answered some questions I've had a long time about the book. But it's certainly one of my favorite books, and the copy that I'm looking at right now is a hardbound copy with the binding broken, that I've been through it so many times. All of the other copies that I've had, I've given away. But I think it's a very good introduction to Bucky, because it's not as challenging as some of his other works, particularly Synergetics. And Greg, the piece that you specifically asked me to talk about was the quote that's on the Somehow I'm getting an echo myself this time. The passage that's in front of the table of contents taken from Synergetics 2 about conventional critical path conceptioning, and he goes on to say it is linear and self-under-informative. That passage is typical of the stuff that scares people away from Bucky, and Synergetics has a lot of that. And I think actually, the point that he's making there, I'll go on and read the rest of the paragraph just so that you can hear the type of language that can be challenging. I'll just start from the top. Conventional critical path conceptioning is linear and self-under-informative. Only spherically expanding and contracting, spinning and polarly involuting and evoluting orbital system feedbacks are both comprehensively and incisively informative. Spherical orbital critical path circuits are pulsative, tidal, importing and exporting. Critical path elements are not overlapping linear models in a plane. They are systemically inter-spiraling complexes of omni-interrelevant regenerative feedback circuits. Now, for anybody never exposed to Bucky, that might scare them off completely, which I think is a shame because I was very inspired by it the first time I read it, and it's to me, beautiful poetry, though complicated to fully understand, taken out of context. I think the point that he's making about critical path thinking, and if you think of the term in terms of, and one of the very important points about this book goes back to project management, and you have a critical path that you must accomplish in order to get something done. In this book, for those that haven't read it, Bucky often points to the Apollo mission, going to the moon and safely landing humans aboard the moon and bringing them back safely, required over 10 million separate critical path steps in order to do that. But that project management, thinking about it, was just a straight linear path. And Bucky is always pointing out how there's much deeper complexity. And actually, if you go to Synergetics and read the next paragraph, he talks specifically about this, and it's much easier to understand what he's talking about. And I'll quote him specifically. When we go out to the Earth orbiting moon and plan to get back into the biospheric enshrouded Earth again, we are dealing in 60,000 mile per second solar spiraling. As the solar system, while part of our galaxy rotates around the galaxy's center at 700,000 miles per hour. This altogether with the intergalactic motion means we can never come back to where we were, even though we safely reached the Earth. So the calculations that were required to actually bring those guys, we'll send them to the moon and back safely, was a very elaborate, complex system understanding that we were able to do. And that's the whole point with critical path, I think. It's our ability to actually do that and understand that complexity. We do understand that we're flying through space like that. And it goes back to the book that we talked about in the last group, Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. So as a rather lengthy introduction, I think that the rest of this book is actually much more easy to understand than that opening passage when taken out of context, and he goes on to explain that, I think, in great detail.
Thanks,
Kurt. I'll turn it over to Pablo.
Thank you, Kurt. Thanks for that, and thank you for this chance. I'm very glad to talk a little bit about one of my favorite books, and I would agree with Elizabeth that in a lot of senses it's at least I would agree with a lot of people that find it as the one book that people should point to that is a is a good entry point because it's so expansive in the reach of the ideas. And so, you know, I'm basically expand upon what has been said and share a little bit more on in a different direction as well. I was going to just second what Greg initially said about Bucky's political awareness and you know, dispelling that naivete that is sometimes existing around the concept of Bucky in politics. Particularly what's got me thinking right now is what's actually happening around the world and how I've experienced something that made me think of Critical Path, particularly the Legally Piggly chapter, because earlier this week there was a very interesting economic debate in my home country of Ecuador, where the president and some of the economic thinkers of the country were sitting around and talking, and even though they couldn't find a lot of agreement around policy, they did reach one agreement that whether it was capitalist or socialist, there was no such thing as an economy that is detached from the politics of it. So it was kind of ahead of this week when we were going to talk about Critical Path. The fact that this was happening on this debate made me think a lot about what Bucky was trying to get at with this book and try to dispel some of the kind of smoke and mirrors that exist in the politics and what is really at stake. So I'm actually going to point to an article by Bucky, 1983. It's called Humanity's Critical Path. And when he closes the article, he says something that I think is particularly inspiring and I think that is still very relevant about this book, Critical Path, and it's this statement, which is that humanity is now experiencing history's most difficult evolutionary transformation. We're moving away from a rooted lifestyle with a 95% rate of illiteracy. We are almost unconsciously drifting away from self-identity with our ages-long, physically islanded from one another existence as 160 separate sovereign nations. Now, the uprooted humans of all nations are spontaneously deploying into their physically integrated highways and airways and satellite relayed telephone speakways into a big city, way station, world around living system. So I do think that we continue to grapple with the same challenge of how to steward an ever more complex system that aims to integrate more and more people. So I do think that Critical Path is a great book to think about the greater context and the stewardship of planet Earth. So with that, I'll just add a little bit of a different kind of angle that exists within the book as well. Greg?
Thanks, Pablo. I'm going to pause here and ask either Elizabeth or Sharif if there are any pressing questions or any questions that have been posed thus far.
There are. Thanks, Greg. And Greg, if you mute when I speak, I think the echo goes away. Great. Thank you. Okay, we have a question that was emailed to us earlier this week that I think is somewhat relevant to the direction that Pablo's taking us in. This is from Alan Frankel, and he writes, even though I have read Bucky's literature like The Critical Path, what does he mean exactly by economically successful? I actually interpret this phrase personally as no poverty and that everyone has what they need on all levels, not just survival and self-sufficient, but with freedom to have and do what one wants or desires as long as one does not harm or infringe upon the rights of others. I may be wrong, but I also see him talking about is a world without money. So I'll open that to all of you to respond to, and perhaps others on the line might also have a response. Just click your hand button. Okay.
Can I respond very quickly?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I got interested and attracted to Bucky as when I was a freshman college student. This was back in 1967. I was an African American freshman student who had gotten interested in the environment. I tell people because I grew up on the banks of Lake Erie and Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio, which were highly polluted and declared, you know, biologically dead. But this was in 1967, and I was sort of called on the carpet by my African-American colleagues when I arrived at Tufts for being committed to the environmental movement. This was a time of the civil rights and Vietnam War, women's rights, and the thing that struck me and hurt me more than anything else was when one of my friends said that he felt that the environmental movement was not just irrelevant to most of the issues around civil rights in this particular case, but almost sinister. And I asked, well, what do you mean? And he explained, well, listen to some of the slogans. Limited growth, no growth. It sounds like a ploy from their point of view to maintain the status quo. Those that have accumulated wealth will keep it, and those of us, which were mostly people of color, who had not achieved a certain economic status, would not be able to do so under that scenario. They couldn't quite see where do we fit into this tree-hugging, save the planet, but at the expense of poor people. And I was in a conundrum because I felt that the two twin goals of economic equality and environmental equality should be compatible and were compatible, but I didn't have an intellectual response until I read Bucky. I went underground and I read Bucky and the whole concept of economic equality, higher standard of living by understanding nature's sort of strategy for doing more with less. And the whole idea that the only way to achieve certain types of economic success is with increased consumption and achieving these sort of artificial goals like, you know, growth domestic products. Some of the things that Bucky points out in Legally Piggly, that we have these contrived sort of measures and ways of measuring the value of economics. And what Bucky showed was that, or at least demonstrated, was that if we could achieve more life support with fewer energy expenditures by doing things like coal generation and realizing that the inputs as in nature, outputs of one system or the inputs of others, that we could, in fact, I think, getting to the point of the letter, bring everyone up to a higher standard of living than anyone had ever lived before without infringing on others' rights and without undermining the ecological integrity of the planet. So while it may sound like a utopian dream, it is clearly, I think, this notion that economic development, not necessarily economic growth, and economic equality was certainly achievable and certainly one of the goals that he had in mind.
Thanks, Greg. Go ahead.
Just to add to that, actually, Greg, thank you for that historical backdrop of your own spot there, and I think that it's interesting that slogan is the sort of thing that was representing the ecological movement at the time, or the ecology movement, excuse me. And I would just say, and to refer to the question, that as Greg pointed out, Bucky was talking about everybody living at a higher standard of living than ever before experienced by anybody on the planet, through doing more with less, or as he called ephemeralization, which in many ways, I think that Bucky was being very anticipatory there, where he saw the ability of technology to actually do that and our ability to apply technology in that way. And I think what he was always doing was urging people to think about how we can do that and then actually take steps to do it. And so the fact that he inspired people like you, Greg, to actually go out there and make changes that hopefully will lead to what Bucky always saw as should be the goal of our development of technology. As far as a world without money goes, I don't know the specific quote that they're talking about there, and I don't recall Bucky talking about a world without money specifically, but eventually the technology, if we get to a point where everybody is taken care of at that level, you would imagine that money would become much less important. And certainly he saw that war, he felt that war would become completely obsolete when everybody has more than enough.
And I guess I would just add, Kurt, to what you just said, quoting Bucky, again, the same article I mentioned earlier, last statement is that, you know, our more with less technology can now enable us to become an omni-integrated, majority literate, unified spaceship society, spaceship Earth society. It is a matter of converting the high technology from weaponry to livingry. The essence of livingry is human life advantaging and environment control. With the highest aeronautical and engineering facilities of the world redirected from weaponry to livingry production, all humanity has the option of becoming enduringly successful, which I believe really connects with what you stated, Greg, earlier in the discussion about really about humanity succeeding. It's about not about Earth, it's really about us successfully enduring. And so I think that I agree with Kurt. I can't speak to the notion of a moneyless society, but I can certainly point to the fact that Bucky was questioning the traditional indicators from the get-go because they do not capture other measures of well-being. So there's a lot of work being done right now to try to understand what human well-being really means. And it's different in a different cultural setting. And I think we have to understand that even our concept of an enduringly successful society might differ across cultures, languages, and geographies.
And just one quick point on money, because I think, you know, there's one section in the book where Bucky talks about how we've lost sort of our sense of the connectedness of certain types of concepts. And he used the example of how some of the early sailors, explorers, had their explorations financed, and they would go and get a loan from the king or the queen, and they would leave behind cattle, for instance, or livestock as collateral. You remember this? And what he would say is, and then they were on their ships and then maybe gone for 2 or 3 years, and when they came back and were successful and brought back their riches, they would return them, give those, you know, their portion to the king and queen, and then they'd ask for their livestock back, and they would be returned. But during that period, there were little baby calves or little baby sheep that were born, and they were kept by the folks who care for them. And as Bucky did, that was interest, but that was real. It was something that was actually generated, and during that time period. And we've taken that concept of interest now to become much more abstract, and it's now led to sort of the whole sort of financial sort of sector where people are swapping, you know, assets over the wire, but don't have a real connection to anything that's real. So I think in terms of money, what we see happening, and it's certainly happening at the little place I work out on in the Berkshires, and it's something that Jane Jacobs, who was also a sort of cohort and a colleague of Bucky, talked about, money needing to really sort of communicate what was going on in people's real lives. And so the what we're looking at is sort of a tendency to create more local currencies, not national currencies that don't give information other than sort of information about the GDP, gross domestic product, but not about what's going on in your community. So as we become more local, I think and that's not to say they're going to see it, you know, total elimination of federal dollars, but there's some very interesting experiments going on in my neck of the woods with a local currency called Berkshares, which encourages people to support their local businesses and local economy. So where that's going to go, it's anybody's guess, but I think that's a good bet that we're going to see a lot more of that.
It's Elizabeth. We've got a bunch of questions piling up here, so I just want to interject and try to get to some of these folks. And I just also wanted to point out that I think there's such an interesting spectrum here between what Pablo was pointing to and quoting from Bucky about our increasing identity as sort of global citizens and the technological systems that are allowing us to experience ourselves in spaceship Earth at the kind of global level, and concurrently this kind of local emphasis on regarding what you're talking about, Greg. I think we're in an interesting time here where both are necessary. They might seem to be in conflict with each other, but they're both also, huge forces currently underway in the global change movement. So with that, I want to invite John Liparelli. I hope I've pronounced your name right, John. I want to invite you to offer your question if you'd like to. Otherwise, I can read it for you if you've just been unmuted. So you had a question about fiat money. Are you there, John?
Yes, I'm here, but I don't know how to work this technology.
Well, we can hear you, and if you can just share with us where you're calling in from, and then just get right to your question. We can hear you. You successfully unmuted.
Well, thank you. My question, I'm calling from Orlando, Florida, and my question was, what was Buckminster Fuller's viewpoint on fiat money and breaking away from gold standard or hard asset backed currency?
Well, thanks, John. So I want to jump in here.
Yeah, if I may, the truth is that actually in Critical Path he goes into a great economic history where he actually expresses a lot of the views he has on the departure from gold standard and actually all the asset back. I would really recommend, I can't recall the chapter, but I might believe it might still be in the Legally Piggly chapter. I do think that Bucky's position or particular stance in the accumulation with fiat, but not only in the sense of money, but in the kind of accumulation through shares that are not connected to real assets or descriptive of the productivity of the assets, I'm not going to say skeptical because that would be too light. I think he was critical outright. And I think the book Grunt of Giants really captures how skeptical he is of the accumulation system that exists and how capital flows are managed. I would say, and connected to the previous topic of discussion, what Greg was talking about, and I would summarize the position as one where it's very clear that while money has value, it has no values. And that is the problem with it and how it is put to work in the world. And it forces the dichotomy of weaponry versus livingry and how productive assets can be. When you invest in technology development, unfortunately, the primary concern has not been to develop tools of livingry, but weaponry. But I think I'm straying away from the original question. So, Greg, I don't know if you want to jump in.
I think the only thing I could add is I think that Bucky was more interested in sort of the functional uses of gold, and he saw that locking it up in places like Fort Knox and then using that as the standard for determining value of things like currency made a lot less sense than trying to understand did it have a a design science, a technological use that would be better put to, right? And I think he would probably say that perhaps if you read some of the stuff, the scrap metal might be a more, you know, there are just certain items that make more sense. So again, connected to some sense of real worth and value as opposed to it becoming the standard. And I believe it is in the chapter on Legally Piggly.
Hey, Greg, this is Jamie. Can I add a... Yep. Whoops, I should put in my headphone. I hear an echo. Just a quick comment to build on
what he's saying. First of all, I on a very specific level, it's interesting, towards the end of the introduction, Bucky actually makes a prediction that is another interesting twist about energy, and it sort of gets to what both of you have been saying, which is he says, I predict that before the end of the 1980s, the computer's politically unbiased problem-solving prestige will have brought about the world's completely integrated energy network grid, which is certainly happening rapidly. But then he goes on to say about economics, this world electric grid with its omni-integrated advantage will deliver electric energy anywhere to anyone at any one time at one common rate. This will make possible a world around uniform costing and pricing system for all goods and services based realistically on time energy metabolic accounting system of universe. So, you know, just to finish that, in this cosmically uniform common energy value system for all humanity, costing will be expressed in kilowatt hours or watt hours and watt seconds of work. So I think that sort of gets to the point, you know, of connecting it with something that's actually has physical consequence in the most direct way. And but I also think it's, on the other side, Bucky certainly speaks at length in this book about, you know, the basic, I think also in the introduction and Legally Piggly, you know, the basic observation that when you put money in a bank, and, you know, if you use this money symbol and then interest is collected on it, but there's no actual value that's been added, you're basically depreciating the value of the money. I mean, you're inflating the currency, and certainly at the very largest scale, as we are all becoming more aware of, the Federal Reserve, you know, generates money. It just presses a button and say, okay, let's release another, you know, $100 billion into the system, but that just means now, if you think about it, you've now just added an extra 100,000 of these symbols. And so it's, you know, I think there is something so elegant and beautiful and orienting about, and this is back to operating manual, but the basic definition that wealth is the capability to support life. And if we realize, sort of make a distinction between wealth and what for the moment are different forms of exchanging wealth, I think there's a lot of sanity that begins to emerge about what's really real.
Thank you.
And just one short comment on that. Legally Piggly is something that I would definitely recommend to the questioner, especially because at the very end, he's talking about cosmic accounting as opposed to the bankruptcy accounting of the world's power structures. And in that chapter, he goes in depth into the Great Depression and how it happened through banking. And it's a very interesting exploration of his ideas about money and how the power structure uses it to stay in power.
So I'm going to jump in here, everybody. We have, you know, a number of questions and a little over half an hour, about 40 minutes. So I want to make sure that we get to everybody. Kelly Ritchie, your question is really right on target with the current thread of the discussion, and then we'll sort of pivot to address some of the other comments, which are sort of open us up to some other important ideas contained in Critical Path. So Kelly, if you want to go ahead and share your comments and questions, welcome, and let us know where you are dialing in from.
Okay, I'm dialing in from Perth, Western Australia.
Welcome.
And I have to say that I'm interested in the opening statement of the book of Critical Path, because it's what's kept me reading Fuller since 1989. And I've read Critical Path so many times, I've had so many study groups on it, that it's, you know, it's just part of what I do. But one of the key questions is what is a body in motion? And if I understand what a body in motion is, then maybe I can make better informed decisions, because when he talks about... And I've never really come clear with that, because you've got a... He talks about macro and micro. And in my view, there's got to be macro bodies in motion, and there's got to be micro bodies in motion. So what really is a body in motion? And then when you get into your money discussion, to me, it's about production of value versus money making money. And I think it was Jamie made the point that it's a cost equation. It's not a price equation. And so as a business owner and as a business guy, I'm always looking at the cost versus the price. And so easy to put up the price without understanding the cost. And to me, cost breaks down into the space that I'm in, the energy that's required, the material that's being created, and then ultimately the value that is added. And so I think that we really have to get into a cost equation versus this idea of pricing. So it really leads back to my original question, what is a body in motion? So I don't know if that adds to the discussion or not, but thank you for hearing it.
Thank you for sharing it.
I would love to offer a comment on that, if I may. I growing up with Bucky, this principle of precession, and which, as he defines it, is the effect of bodies in motion on other bodies in motion. It's a very central principle to Bucky. And, you know, I think, like all generalized principles, and this was, I think, one of the great gifts of Bucky, is to say the universe has a fundamental design, and we begin to get a sense of the way that nature works. But as we discover these principles, they're universal. They don't just relate to a money system or to a engineering system. They show up in our lives and in the social dynamics of the way we relate. And I think, you know, one of the most meaningful chapters of this book for me personally has always been the self-disciplines, because I think, he talks so much about the relationship between his own initiatives. I forget the actual little passage where I was reading this as I was flipping through things recently, but the impact that our own initiative makes on the world around us, and this feedback system that the nature provides us, that when the system is regenerating, when I'm taking an initiative that is regenerating itself, that's a loop. That's an energy feedback loop, just like electromagnetism regenerates itself at the speed of light. Electricity, fosters the magnetism, which fosters the electricity at, uncomprehendable frequencies. But I think, and then Bucky said, and then I learned when I began to find the feedback loop, where I wasn't economically getting on, as he would put it, the feedback loop, he began to learn that this was nature's way of steering him. of saying, you know, you're sort of going down, getting off track here a little bit, so we're sort of cutting down the current that's going to you. And he would immediately, as he noticed that, then shift course. So I think, you know, these principles apply at every level. And so when you think of, you know, bodies in motion, it could be, I think the first time I started thinking about it had to do with, you know, my first girlfriend, you know, and how do I interact with my first girlfriend, you know, so that I will attract her as opposed to shying her, you know, sending her away. And so, you know, I think if you think about these things in the most generalized way, then you begin to see how this dynamic shows up everywhere, and certainly in the business realm as well as every other.
I agree. This is Greg. I mean, just two quick things, picking up on Jamie's point, the procession piece is really important, because, again, as Bucky, the whole idea of two bodies in motion, and what happens is that most of the critical life support functions in nature happen inadvertently, as nature has programmed, for instance, species to satisfy certain drives, whether it's the bee collecting honey from the flowers and inadvertently cross-pollinating at a 90-degree angle. It's always sort of that sort of, you're driven by survival drives, but you create and the life support or perform the larger function unconsciously. What we as humans can do, and this is sort of the experiment, our function that Bucky said as conscious participants in evolution, is that we can do that for participating in the co-evolution of the planet consciously, not inadvertently. If we understand that this is what, as the gentleman said, the questioner, that we're all in motion and that we can't do just one thing. It's impossible. So let's see if we could focus on what it is that nature is trying, how nature is trying to make us a success, and do that directly. And that relates to the whole idea of cost and trying to figure out the economics, because, again, as Bucky pointed out, if we were to consciously design our buildings with ideas in mind, for instance, how much does a building weigh? What if we could produce our own energy rather than rely, you know, that becoming sort of a burden? It becomes something that's a part of the business itself, because we've got that fuel cell or we've got that wind turbine there, that it begins to change the equation and put the power back into our hands as opposed to some corporate or government entity.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm just going to start to get, we've got a lot of questions piling up. So
You do it.
Let's see, we were going to go to Norman Fellows, but I'm going to quickly ask Alan Bull to offer your comments, because they're specifically about critical path, and then Norman, we will come right to you after that. So Alan, if you can, you've sent us a couple comments, if you can just share them, or a question you might have, and we'll take it from there. Thank you, and please share where you're joining us from.
I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, which is an intellectual and spiritual ghetto, so I've already been enlightened by the participation of this book. And I want to thank Greg for reminding me that we have some things in common. I was a VISTA volunteer trying to win the war on poverty, and after 4 years I realized that we had the wrong tools. I was in southern Illinois in the early 1970s. But here's my question based on the topic of making the invisible visible. To me, critical path sets the context to understand what we're doing as passengers on spaceship Earth. What I would wonder is, with the collective experience and knowledge of the people on this call and others, is there any sense that we can go from critical path to what I just invented, thanks to all of you, what I would call the constructive pathways, so that the individuals, passengers, can better connect all of the things that we've learned from Bucky and better apply it practically as individuals? Because it seems to me that's where the disconnect is between the concepts and the concrete things that I can make choices to do tomorrow. So I'm throwing it out to the group. Is there any constructive pathway kinds of thinking so that we can get people on board Spaceship easier on an individual basis first, rather than spending all the time trying to understand all the context?
Somebody want to else want to?
Sure, I'll.
Okay.
Actually, I think that the letter that Bucky quotes at the end of the introduction, the Twilight of the World's Power Structures, from a 10-year-old boy named Michael, about the doers, asking him if he's a doer or a thinker, and Bucky gives him some very good advice about what he should do, and I encourage you to read it, because and it ends, and you have what is most important in life, initiative. Because of it, you wrote to me, and I'm answering the best of my ability. You will find that the world responds to your earnest initiative. And I think that that's the key pathway, that he's always encouraging everybody to look around them and see what needs doing, and then think about it and do what they see needs to be done. And that's the crucial thing, taking that initiative, as he always did.
And I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's a great question. But there is a whole lot that's going on, and maybe one of the other things that we need to make visible, and I think, you know, the Buckminster Fuller Institute is doing a lot of that, is the work that is actually going on and the tools that are actually being developed by a lot of innovative and creative people, tools that can be used by individuals or communities to start making those changes today. And it's part of it is the unearthing of those individuals by the as a result of the Buckminster Fuller Initiative, right? I mean, I think that's part of it. I just came from a meeting a week and a half ago with the Bioneers out in California, 3,000 people there, and there are an amazing number of people that are creating those tools that are putting us on that path. And I think the idea, what we've got to do is a little better. Now, many of them are the invisible, and we've got to do a lot more work at making those individuals and those tools visible to make those connections. I kind of go back to looking at the incredible role of the Whole Earth Catalog way, way back when, for those of you old enough to remember that. But I think your question is right, and I think that it is going on, and we just got to figure a way to get the right tools into the right hands, and part of that is shedding the current power structure.
Thanks, Greg. I'm going to jump in here and invite Norman Fellows to join us and share your, comment and question. Welcome.
Okay.
Let us know where you're coming from.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. Okay. Well, I live in a small town in the middle of France called Confolon, but I'm from England. My question, if I read my question out, in A Framework for Change, which Michael Benelli wrote in 2007, he said, some science and technological projects incorporate virtually millions of steps with zero error tolerance, a critical need to anticipate all possible eventualities, and he goes on, and the inclusion of essential milestones for which basic science may not yet exist at the time when the project is launched. But it's this critical need to anticipate all possible eventualities that's caught my eye and is the focus of my question. So how can we apply the idea of critical path to the operation of Spaceship Earth? You referred earlier to the Apollo mission, and it seems to me that although complex, it's much less complex than the operation of Spaceship Earth. I don't know the answer to my own question, but how can we apply the idea of critical path to the operation of Spaceship Earth?
Thank you. It's a beautiful and very important question. Do you want to jump in?
Well, I will just say that Bucky addressed exactly what you mentioned there. He on page I guess it's 19, it's XIX, in the introduction, he says, as of 1980, the successful solution of the myriad of social, economic, psychological problems.
Can I interrupt you really fast? Greg, would you mute yourself? Oh, there you go. Okay, go ahead, Kurt.
Sorry. As of 1980, the successful solution of the myriad of social, economic, psychological problems now existent is obviously a more difficult task for humanity to address than was the achieving of the Apollo project. And then he goes on to basically say that reading Critical Path is the first step in actually helping. He says, for those who care to know how we're going to accomplish the 1989 omni-success of humans on spaceship Earth, it is necessary to invest the rest of this hour in the reading of this introduction. And he goes on to explain that this is the first step, and that's where he's encouraging people to take initiative.
I guess I would quickly respond by saying that, you know, one of the other things though that Bucky points out is that there's no guarantee that we're going to make it. He says, you know, he as he points out in many of his writings, that, you know, it seems like nature has programmed us and is bound and determined to make us a success, but that's not a guarantee. And if you look at the challenges now that we're facing with climate change, and I'll just use that as an example, there's just no question that we really do have to figure out. And I think it's sort of puts us our backs against the wall to come up with those solutions that are really sort of unprecedented. And I think that the talks that are coming up hopefully will be more than just talks, but certainly is putting us in the position of sort of it's the pass or fail sort of phase of us. And there's no guarantee. So I do think that we're in that situation where we really will have to figure out what it's going to take for us to unite and come up with a unified strategy for pulling us out of what is probably, as he says, you know, the last exam.
Thanks, Greg. I'm going to now we're going to move over to Peter Meissen. Welcome, Peter. I'm so glad you've joined us. And please share with everybody where you are on Spaceship Earth, and invite you to jump in with your comments and questions. Peter, are you there? Should I read it? Just in case he's having technical difficulties, I'm just going to read Peter's comment, and then we can have a quick response, and then we'll move on. Thanks for bringing the interconnected electric grid with an emphasis on tapping abundant renewables into the conversation earlier. This remains the planet's highest priority objective to solve the challenges of sustainable development, poverty elimination, and climate mitigation consequences. Peter's organization, GENI, G-E-N-I, which is genie.org, has just sent an open letter to COP21 Paris climate experts to make, quote, linkable renewables a priority in every nation. Thank you for that, Peter, and for your continuing great, great work in San Diego. I encourage you all to check out Peter's website, www.genie.org. Do our panelists want to respond to Peter?
I think that this is Greg, real quick. Good point. And, you know, that electric grid, the world-round grid that Bucky envisioned, you know, decades ago, has the potential for doing a number of things. One, it really can address, you know, by taking advantage of the, you know, night and day and the changes in the earth, really sort of create something that makes a lot of sense in terms of a continuous flow of energy, taking and looking at the natural flow of energy. But it also will probably go a great deal towards the breakdown of nations, which is something also that Bucky felt was sort of like, you know, those blood clots that were really restricting the real flow of information and cooperation and collaboration that is inevitable, or at least absolutely necessary, if we're going to succeed.
I would just add a quick comment, just that, you know, it just seems, it's important, it seems, to reflect that, in my view, to use a term that most of the people in the world wouldn't use, there is a huge design science revolution that's underway on this planet. And people don't use that name, but it's happening at all levels. And yes, of course, we hope that at any moment the world's governments will sort of come together with the Marshall Plan that's going to address all this effectively. But I think we're all enough along the way not to be holding our breath for that. So there actually is a revolution of initiative going on that's dramatically changing things in countries and regions all over the world. But also let's balance that with the fact that, you know, Bucky talked about trim tabs, and not to overlook the fact that it all, you know, where do we go next? Well, maybe after you're done reading the introduction, it always comes back to us as little trim tabs, and especially the very important realm of transformation that's happening at the local level over the planet, where local examples, you know, a kind of relocalizing of the economic and engagement systems is a very important dynamic. So, you know, each one of us has our own place and our own contribution to make. And as Bucky would say at the end of talks, you know, people always come up and say, okay, Bucky, you know, but what should I do? He says, you know, I don't know what you should do. That's what the individual's about. It's about asking ourselves, what am I in a unique position to do? What needs to be done that's going to really help people, and what am I in a unique position to do? That's each of our homeworks, day in, day out, if we want to turn this thing around. And just to second the idea that the design science revolution is actually happening now, I think that there is a worldwide power grid now. It's not exactly the electrical power grid that Bucky was imagining, but the spread of the internet and the connection of individuals to information and to each other, I think, is one of the prime technological transformations of the planet that, and I think it's key, and has really opened the power up to individuals and threatens the world's power structures like nothing else ever before. And in Critical Path, Bucky does talk about how radio was the first thing that really spread information in a very vast way, and now that information is two-way, and I think that really is a big change in the power structure of the planet.
Thank you, everybody. So we're going to shift gears a little bit and invite Patricia, who's been waiting so patiently, to share her question and comment and what you're working on, Patricia. Welcome, and please let us know where you're coming dialing in from.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm calling from Corte Madera, California, Marin County, and I have written a book partially based on a true story about a young woman and her getting wisdom from Buckminster Fuller and then sort of grappling a long time with what to do with that information. And I've got people looking at it now. Amy Edmondson is reading it this weekend, which I'm very excited about. Bill McKibben likes it, which I thought was a big thumbs up. But what I would like to know from you utmost, most amazing Bucky experts is, if there were just one idea that you could put into the minds of young people, because the novel's aimed at young people, what would be the most important idea that Bucky shared that is important for people to be thinking about today? What's the most important idea?
Well, anybody gonna honestly, I would say that the idea that, that he said that when each of us is born, we are the particular answer to a problem in the universe at that time, and that our lives mirror the evolution of the universe, and that we have a role and a function to play if we accept it. And I don't mean that, to me, it's not just a metaphor. It really is. That's why we're here. And collectively, we are able to do what needs to be done to create a world that works for everyone.
And I would just say, I refer back to the letter that's in Critical Path to the 10-year-old, and Bucky says it very directly to him, and I think you're talking about to young people, and he's writing directly to this boy, Michael. He said, "Thank you very much for your recent letter concerning thinkers and doers. The things to do are the things that need doing, that you see need to be done, and that no one else seems to see needs to be done. Then you will conceive your own way of doing that which needs to be done, that which no one else can told you to do or how to do it. This will bring out the real you that often gets buried inside the character that has acquired a superficial array of behaviors induced or imposed by others on the individual." So I think that is really a key core message, and I think probably the most important, because it's essential we take our own initiative.
That you don't have to ask permission.
Jamie and Pablo, do you want to? Am I off mute?
I would agree. I mean, I think both of you have said that very well, and I think Bucky, the beautiful idea of the trim tab is really, in its essence, it's about the basic fact that especially when we think about systems and complex problems like the predicament in which we find ourselves in, the recognition that everything we do or don't do makes a difference.
Yeah, I fully second that, Jamie. I think that in everything that we've heard, and you know, the deep lesson at the heart of what Bucky is talking about is not only this initiative in doing things, but the initiative in thinking and doing your own thinking.
So we have a question from Bill Fisher. Back to Patricia. Bill, do you want to jump in and let us know where you're joining us from?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm from Fort Worth, Texas. The woman that was just talking, she was describing a book, and I didn't know if that book was available or if we could read that book. I was just interested to know more about it.
Oh, Patricia, do you want to jump in?
Well, it's written, and then it's rewritten, and it's always in editing, but I do have sort of an agent who's looking for an agent for me, the right one. So no, it's not available yet. Although, as I said, I am interested in getting some early critiques, especially of the, you know, everything that I write that Bucky said, I've pulled from something that he wrote. So I believe it to have a lot of veracity already. But I want to make sure that the ideas sort of hold together and make sense and are in line with what Bucky's grandson and people who are, you know, familiar with Bucky will be proud to see in writing, and not feel, not cringe and think, ooh, that sounds stupid or whatever. You know, because it's hard to try to be an expert on a genius when you're not.
Jamie, do you want to respond? Or thank you, Patricia. And certainly, when you are you know, ready to share it, please let us know, and we in turn will let our network know. We have a question from Leah Baines. Leah, do you want to jump in and share where you're joining us from? Leah, I'll share her question. What was the, quote, destination the critical path beckons?
I'm sorry, that's the question? What is the...
What was the, quote, destination the critical path beckons?
A world that works for 100% of humanity and without ecological offense and without the disadvantage of anyone. A world that works for 100% of life on a regenerative basis.
Great. Thank you, Jamie. So we have just about 5 minutes left. I just would want... like to invite Greg and Jamie and Pablo and Kurt, if you have any sort of last thoughts you want to share or things that came up in the discussion that you feel would be are your sort of takeaways, and additionally we will be having a second session on Critical Path, and if there are things in the book that you want to recommend that we really either think about as we read the book or really look to in the text, that would be also a wonderful contribution.
Well, I think this has been, I appreciate the comments that folks have made. It's a very difficult format, obviously, that, you know, we all know that, as you said, this is a very dense book. There's a lot that's contained in Critical Path, and obviously we can touch on the surface. I think part of the idea of having these sessions is to help folks connect, and I don't know if we do have a record or an ongoing record of the folks who are participating, or if there's any way that we can sort of, there's an attempt to sort of keep the network intact beyond this. I think it would be very important, because early on for me, it was pretty lonely out there to try to find folks who were sort of interested and pursuing the same critical path that we're talking about today. So I appreciate